Smestions.
It sounded slightly quiet to me.
Did. They'll fix it in post.
They will. They'll just sort of crank it up.
They'll also cut out the gap between you saying, here's the music, and them going, oh, we have to do something, press the button.
But obviously there wasn't a gap.
No, there wasn't when you heard it then, but that's because they fixed it in post.
You said, you made a reference a while back on take two to turning up to 11.
Yes.
And there's another Spinal Tap on the way.
There is another Spinal Tap on the way.
So that's quite interesting.
Which I'm hugely looking forward
to. Apparently Paul McCartney and Elton John are both in it.
Okay.
So.
Yeah, but there's also an element of me that's worried because I don't want it to be anything other than brilliant.
Callum in London, I have a question for your question schmestion segment.
Yes.
When actors attend glitzy premieres in Leicester Square and Los Angeles and the like, do they actually sit there for the entire evening and watch their own film every time? I imagine for major blockbusters, where there are multiple premieres in capitals across the world, they wouldn't actually want to watch the film that they'd just finished, making several times over a period of couple of weeks. Do they therefore sneakily leave once the press cameras are out of the way, perhaps to a nearby bar or even just go home? I'd be interested to know what light you can shed on this.
Yes, the answer is it depends. If you listen to the Joaquin Phoenix interview about Napoleon, he said at one point, I don't know which take Ridley used, which implies to me that he hadn't watched the finished film. And I know that there are some actors who don't. They believe that all the work is done on set and they won't. And it wouldn't surprise me if Joaquin Phoenix was one of those. If you're can somewhere with a film that is being shown for the first time, you quite often will get the director or cast or crew will sit there and watch it or at Venice or one of the big film festivals, and they will sit in the room and watch it. Generally, by the time you get to Leicester Square premieres, they've seen it and they'll go on at the beginning and they'll say, we hope you enjoy the film and we'll be here afterwards for questions. And then they will retire to the nearest hostelry.
Yes.
Because, for obvious reasons.
Why would they want to watch it again?
Yeah. But as I said, I know there are some circumstances under which people will choose not to watch their own films. And I think there's something really terrifying about the idea of seeing a film for the first time with an audience. If I were a filmmaker or an actor, which I am none of those things, and so please send the usual deluge of emails. In that case, what right do you have to be a critic? I understand that argument. I think the idea, if I had made something, I would want to see it on my own.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I know, for example, Dave Norris, Last Projection is Standing, has told me, I won't have to say who, but there have been many occasions in which he has screened a film for one person because they want to see it before the premiere. They want to know what it is. I mean, I think the idea of watching a film for the first time in a room full of people is a terrifying thought. They have cast and crew screenings, don't they? So it's, you know, that's like everyone involved in the project.
I think it was a premiere, presumably it was because the cast were there, of the last Knives Out film.
Oh, yeah.
And the cast all came in, they did the interviews, and I know they all stayed because they were sitting in a row adjacent to mine.
Right.
And as the lights were going down, a voice very similar to Daniel Craig said, everyone take their seats, because it was Daniel Craig. And to be honest, as it's his film, he can shout anything he wants.
But he didn't do it in the Benoit Blanc voice.
No, he didn't. But they all, case, they all stayed. But like you said, there are many cases where they just walk in and walk straight out again.
Yeah, exactly. And particularly if you are on the tour of premieres, you know, and if you'd made Oppenheimer, that's 3 hours a night, you know, so.
Catherine says, how long does it take to record the podcast? Having just recorded my first interview today, I have a new appreciation for the art of coherent ad-libbing, which we have never yet achieved. I would love to hear a little about the process. Well, Catherine, it's a very good question. It takes weeks to cobble it together. We start about 9:30 and we finish about 1:00. And we do it all together.
Yes, yes.
Does that spoil the illusion? I don't think so. I don't know.
No, I mean, it's 9:30, 10:30, 11:30, 1:00. So it's about, we record for about 3.5 hours. And out of that, we get 5 coherent minutes. And then we get ChatGPT to fill in the rest.
Yeah. I did an interview with Van Morrison many years ago. And it ran for 25 minutes. We edited it to 3 because that was all we could get that was actually usable. So it's a bit like that.
Two kinds of people in the world. People that like Van Morrison and people that have met Van Morrison.
That's very good. Who said that?
I don't know, but it's a great feeling.
Thomasina in Edgware. Which celebrity, alive or dead, gives you, this bit's in quotes,
okay,
made a deal with the devil in exchange for his or her soul vibes?
Oh, that's a...
So explain the parameters of what that means. So
okay.
Thomasina in Edgware is suggesting that there might... So it's a celebrity who you suspect the only... This is now I'm kind of padding this out.
Okay, okay.
The only reason they've got where they are now or back in the day is because they sold their soul to the devil. So to my, this, what I understand by this, Thomasina, is this is not someone that you hate. This is not someone
who's... not someone who's rubbish.
No, it's not someone
who's the opposite, talentless.
It's also not someone who is obviously evil, because if you've made a pact with the devil, you're going to appear to be great.
Yes.
So I think what this is someone who is... So talented, you think
that can't be right.
There's something wrong there. Or maybe that's just jealousy speaking, but someone who's definitely good looking and fantastically talented at what they do. That's
okay.
Well, deal with the devil.
Okay. Well, on the basis of that, and I don't mean because I, on the basis of that, the name that springs to mind is Tom Cruise, because Tom Cruise is 105.
Yes.
And yet he looks like a 23-year-old. The scene in Top Gun, Maverick, when he takes his top off and plays beach volleyball, you go,
oh, come
on. I'm sorry. How is it possible for somebody of your age to look like that?
He was at the crossroads with the devil.
I suppose this selling your soul to the devil thing goes back to the Robert Johnson myth is that Robert Johnson went down to the crossroads, which is just outside Clarksdale, and he met the devil and he sold his soul to the devil, in return for which he became the greatest blues guitarist of all time. And he recorded that very small number of recordings that there are of Robert Johnson that are then the basis of all blues music. Yeah. But the theory was there's no way that somebody could have been that talented without there being some kind of Mephistophelian or Faustian pact.
So I
would say... Tom Cruise, not on the basis that I think there's anything demonic or devilish about Tom Cruise, quite the opposite. I would say on the basis of how can he be throwing himself off a mountain on a motorbike and doing it, and then acquitting himself so well in interviews. I mean, everything about him, it's not right. It's not right.
I will, it's quite a tough challenge, but obviously I think Roger Federer has to be included.
Oh, on the same basis?
Well, on the same basis, because not only was he the most... I mean, I saw him play a number of times.
Oh, I never...
Not only was he stunningly successful, winning everything, he was incredibly elegant, very good-looking, clearly loves his family, and an all-round great guy. So...
Therefore,
definitely
something wrong.
Definitely something
definitely
wrong.
Definitely something
there.
Wrong there.
Too, basically, it's someone who's too good to be true. Yeah. That's what Thomasina
is. And that's why, for example, Orson Welles wouldn't count. Because if you got Orson Welles just after Citizen Kane, mm-hmm. maybe. But then Orson Welles, the whole of the rest of his career, he was just fighting everyone and, you know, everything. Never got Final Cut again, never got... The trick is they just keep getting it right, yeah? That things just don't go wrong for them. That is different to being, you know, demonic and devilish, like... Trump. Incidentally, wasn't it great to hear Liz Truss endorsing a Republican victory?
I don't know. Did she?
She did. She said that what they need in America is a Republican victory. It's good to know that the shortest serving British Prime Minister, the person who managed to tank the economy in the smallest amount of time, is perfectly behind a 91 indictment.
Alexandra McEwen.
Charges for being the head of the...
Medium-term listener, first-time emailer from Sunny Showbiz, South Tottenham. My partner and I have recently been rewatching seminal action series. We've just finished The Bournes, and now we're in heated debate about how to refer to Keanu's Matrix films. Mm-hmm. I argue for matrices, as this is grammatically correct,
as opposed to matrixes.
Whereas Max is adamant it should be matrixes. He has never seen a Scorsese film, which is sort of not relevant to the point that you're trying to make.
Except it enabled you to say Scorsese.
Long may you and the splendiferous production team keep up the good work. The trouble is, the plural of matrix is matrices,
but
you just sound such a knob if you say that.
I also think that because it's a title, it's not a thing. The matrix isn't a matrix. The matrix is a film. Therefore, I would say it has to be the matrixes.
Yes, I think so. Or the easiest thing is say the Matrix films.
Or the Matrix, yeah, yeah, exactly, the Matrix movies.
That feels less clumsy.
Or yeah, yeah, exactly. Or the ones in which they wear all the rubber.
Gregor from Slovenia. Just saw Napoleon, didn't care for it at all, as I didn't really care for any of the Ridley Scott films that he's made since The Martian, House of Gucci being the worst of them, but I'm glad it exists because of your review, which was hilarious. I am wondering, do you think so many missteps in the late stage of a career can tarnish the legacy of a great director?
I mean,
he's talking also about later on in this email about Coppola. He said it's crazy how he went from Godfather and Apocalypse Now to Jack and Twixt.
Yes, it is. Tarnish the legacy is a very specific phrase, okay? Because tarnish the legacy means, you know, what they have left behind after they are. A legacy is something that exists after you have gone.
Mm-hmm.
So do I think for one moment that people will remember the later Coppola films, or will they talk about The Godfather and Apocalypse Now? Do I think for a moment that... So I mean, like, I don't think so. I think that there are many, many cases of filmmakers. Incidentally, I mean, I think Ridley Scott is doing work now that is really good. And but I think there are many directors who have a period in which they make brilliant work, and then later on they make less brilliant work, but their legacy is the brilliant work. And I think in order to...
It would be good if Robert De Niro stopped.
Yes, but...
But he's still done great work.
And he's good in Killers of the Flower Moon. And if he'd stopped, he wouldn't be doing that. I mean, as far as I understand, the reason given for De Niro suddenly doing a lot of movies was that he was funding the Tribeca Film Festival. In the same way that the reason Ellen Burstyn turns up in... I mean, this is a good example. Ellen Burstyn turns up in Exorcist Believer because what it was doing was it was funding a scholarship program. So... Yeah, no, I don't think so. I think good work is good work is good work.
Here is a very interesting question, which we are not going to be expected to answer.
Okay.
From Tom in London.
Right.
Long-time listener, winner of a perm in a tombola in about 1987 when I was 10. Frequent emailer, thanks for sometimes reading them out, though there's never any offence when they're a bit niche and you don't. Talking of which, this is a follow-up to the listener who was worried about his MRI scan, which we've already mentioned once in take two. I have some advice to pass on, but then I want Radiographer's Recess to chip in and tell me if there's any truth at all in what I've said.
Okay.
So I don't think we're going to be able to answer this question. If you are a radiographer or you know someone, then maybe you can help us out.
We'd love to hear from you.
Tom says, I've had dozens of MRI scans. I've had a dodgy brain for 25 years and the NHS stubbornly insists on keeping me alive, the swines. During some...
That's a lovely turn of phrase.
During some, and not to concern your correspondent, I would get quite severe tingling sensation, somewhere north of pins and needles, but not quite an electric shock, but unwanted, especially when the scans can last 45 minutes.
Yeah.
I just grinned and put up with it, thinking that's what MRIs felt like. I'm fairly chilled out about the whole process having had so many. But on one fairly recent scan, as I lay down, I relaxed by linking my hands across my chest and I crossed my legs for comfort while wearing shorts. The person working the machine said, "Do you get a tingling feeling when you're in there?" And I said, "Yes." He explained that if you have skin-on-skin contact while in the scanner, it can cause this sensation. So I uncrossed my legs, unlinked my fingers, and have never had that unpleasant feeling since.
Wow.
So,
wow,
radiographers, is there any truth in what I've said? I mean, obviously, that's your experience, so therefore it's true. But does skin contact cause these shocks? And if so, can someone explain why? I just know the advice seemed to work for me, so I'm happy to pass it on to the reluctant patient and anyone else who cares to know it. Tell him it'll be fine. The scan is always better than the alternative, which is fair enough.
Yeah, yeah.
So is there any science there, or is it just that Tom was told that and then it worked for him?
Yeah. Wow. I mean, obviously, we don't know. So thank you. Yes, we throw this open to the audience and let us know. In the same way as we throw open to the audience, is there any way of stopping your computer or phone showing you memories from the past which you don't want to see? And as far as I can tell, the answer to that is no.
I bet there most definitely must be.
Well, if there is, please let me know, because I really want my computer to stop showing me pictures from 10 years ago.
Beer in Cardiff. What is the most elegant word in the English language?
Oh.
What is the most elegant word? So I will suggest mellifluous. I think it's
Because it sounds like what it means.
Well, I think it's nice to say. I think an elegant word is something that is pleasing to just say it.
Yeah, mellifluous.
And I think you want Stephen Fry to answer. But
no, that is good.
Dappled.
Dappled, yeah, dappled is a lovely word. We are getting into this woody sort of word, tinny.
Yes,
tinny
but sometimes. I think that's...
No, mellifluous is very good. Elbow?
No, Simon Paul has just said elbow, which I don't think works at all.
Yeah, I like the word sanctimonious.
How about serendipity?
So serendipity, that's lovely.
Also, its meaning is nice.
Yeah. Yes.
But also mellifluous is...
Could you have a mellifluous serendipity?
I don't know. Anyway, this could be...
Maybe that's if you're composing and you just, you know, two notes seem to fall together. Maybe that is a mellifluous serendipity.
This is Ian, Agile Project Management Practitioner.
What?
I'm just saying that's what it says on his CV.
Really? What does that mean?
Agile Project Management Practitioner. Don't know, but he's... Is it the project that's agile?
Or is he?
But agile has got a capital A, so.
But is he an agile project management person, or is he practitioner? Or
no, I think it's an agile project of which he's managing and practicing. Anyway,
okay.
Dear that one and the other, a quick schmestion. Do either of you have any tattoos? If so, what? If not, why not? And what would you get? Down with studios firing their lead actors for daring to call a spade, and up with their co-stars quitting in solidarity, even if officially they're claiming it's because of scheduling issues. That's Scream 7, I think he's talking about. But, very easy to answer. No, I don't have any tattoos. I don't think you have any tattoos.
I did, but I don't.
Well, you had it scrubbed off.
Yeah, it was slightly more clumsy than that.
Cut off.
I did, but I don't.
What was it?
It was a mistake.
I see. So there's someone.
Said Chelsea Boot Boys.
Okay.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't a name or anything like that. It was. It was just an
was
image.
Was it BBC Radio 5 Live?
That was exactly
909
what it was.
And 693.
Yeah. No, it was Adam and the Ants. No, it was. There was a point in my life when I decided it would be a good idea to get a, I think it was like a, it's like about that big, it was like a bird or something. And then I just didn't like it. But now I don't have it anymore.
Child one is...
I would say this to anyone considering getting a tattoo, you know, great, fine, you know, brilliant, all the rest of it. Think hard because, you know, what's it?
Stay for a while.
What's the phrase? Err in haste, repent at your leisure. You know, it's like something might seem like a really good idea at the time.
Yeah. There are some kind of pastimes and hobbies where having a tattoo is a thing. Cycling and running are two of them.
Yeah.
And child one is a cycler and a runner, and he has beaucoup de tat.
Beaucoup de tat.
Yeah. And child three has none. And then child two turned up with a tattoo, which he hadn't discussed, but she has, I think this is okay to say. I shall ask her.
Okay.
She has, in Roman numerals, the birth date of her two brothers.
Which is a lovely thing to have.
Which is very nice.
It's an absolutely lovely thing to have.
And yeah. So child one has done reciprocal. Child three has no intention of getting any tattoos at all, and nor do I.
Yeah.
But interesting development, the good lady ceramicist, her indoors, now has the birth dates of all three kids in Roman numerals on her arm.
Well, there we go. That's absolutely lovely. Yeah, good.
And Millwall FC on the other arm.
Exactly. Chelsea Boot Boys.
Okay. I think we've got time. I don't like that question, so I'm not actually going to do it.
Okay.
I'm going to do this one instead. Jack says, Dear Pastry and Fasting Day or Other Pastry, I'm finally writing in after listening for half of my life. 31 years old, I've been listening since I was 14 and a half, due to getting very excited by listening to Mark talk about his pizza eating method. Thinking, brilliant, there is someone else in the world other than me who conforms to this method of eating a pizza.
Oh, good. Okay.
I have also been doing this for many years. The falling to sleep technique that Simon has mentioned, me choose, which I think I was talking about walking around old houses and old schools and things like that, which I tried last night and it absolutely didn't work.
Because you didn't sleep at all last night, 3 hours, did you?
So. Yeah. I've always taken inspiration from film more so. Oh, no, sorry, I've skipped a paragraph because I'm so tired. Anyway, I also
Funny, you can't sleep at night, but right now you're struggling to stay awake.
I usually choose my old school buildings and going into every room one by one and remember as much detail as possible. I'm usually asleep by the second room, if not the first. But for some reason, it was the pizza similarity that made me email in. As a painter whose paintings could sometimes be described as cinematic, I have always taken inspiration from film more so than photographs. I remember Mark talking about the street... Oh, it's got nothing to do with the pizza at all. About the streetlight shot from The Exorcist being informed or inspired by René Magritte's Empire of Light. My question is, are there any other paintings that either of you know that have inspired films, or maybe more interestingly, are there any films that have inspired paintings?
Well, as far as the paintings that have inspired films, it's almost now impossible to find a painting that hasn't. I mean... It becomes a default thing now for film critics to say that, you know, Vermeer-like images. I think every single Vermeer painting at some point has been cited by a film. When Guillermo del Toro is making films, he looks more towards paintings than he does towards, you know, other movies or that sort of stuff. So, yeah, that happens all the time. Paintings that have inspired, films that have inspired paintings is a slightly different case. There are a number of art installations that are inspired directly by film. I mean, I remember when I was doing the culture show, you know, you'd quite often be sent to look at and to interview somebody about an artwork that had been inspired by films. There was one artist, forgive me for not remembering her name at the moment, but she did this extraordinary artwork, which was, I think it was Apocalypse Now, that she wrote the entire plot of Apocalypse Now on a canvas from beginning to going across. Which when you looked at the thing, it was like a dense text. And when you actually got close to it, it was the entire plot of the film. And she was doing a lot. I know this because the good lady Professor Her Indoors had written some stuff about, or most of the stuff that I know that's worth knowing, I got from Mile and a Half. But she had interviewed her, Tacita Dean, I think. Is that the name? Tacita Dean? And anyway, so yes, there are plenty of artists that have been inspired by film, but it's really now hard to find a popular painting that has not been cited by a filmmaker as an inspiration. Scorsese is the same. He constantly cites painters. Caravaggio, every single cinematographer at some point cites Caravaggio as an influence.
Two questions to go. Helen says, do you have a genre of film you find more difficult to enjoy? For me, it is the Western. While I've enjoyed more modern takes on the genre, I find the more famous traditional films quite inaccessible with macho posturing and lack of character depth. I'm not a fan of horror.
Okay, let me just correct myself. Tacita Dean didn't do that thing. Tacita Dean did the thing in the Tate Britain, which was the huge monolith that was the size of the monolith from 2001, but also looked like a strip of film. Sorry, carry on.
So my
apologies, Tacita. I did interview you about that, so sorry.
Is she a vanguardista?
I don't know, okay, but should be.
Let's assume that she is. Yeah. So genre of film that you find more difficult.
So what are we doing? We just read that again because I was...
Because you weren't listening?
I was trying to correct myself about Tacita Dean because so I don't like listening. Anything. So I wasn't listening.
Do you have a genre of film that you find more difficult to enjoy? For Helen, it's the Western.
Okay.
Your least favourite, I suppose. I prefer not to see horror. I don't like trippy films either. I don't know if that's a genre.
What trippy films have you seen?
That one we did last year or the year before. That one. In the Earth, In the Ground.
Oh, the Ben Wheatley?
Yes.
Oh, I like that.
I know, but I'm answering the question.
Okay. Honestly, I don't think there is a genre of film that I don't like. I mean, partly I think it's because of the job. I think if you had a whole genre of film that you didn't like...
Yeah, it would be a struggle, wouldn't it? It
would be a struggle. There are certainly genres of films of which I am less fond, I suppose. But even if I think of, you know, if you think of something like, you know, historical costume drama. Well, no, Napoleon's a historical costume drama. And, you know, Barry Lyndon is a historical costume drama. No, I honestly don't think... There is. I'll tell you what it would be. I don't particularly like well, those kind of whatever they're called now, the, you know, kind of gross out comedies like The Hangover and all that. I don't like those particularly. Although there are gross out comedies that I have enjoyed. No, I don't think there is a genre of film that I don't like.
Finally, Gina in Nuneaton, what's the shortest time each of you have managed to stick a job and why did you leave?
Well, do you want to go first? Or?
Well, I've tended to stick at everything pretty much. I don't, because my first job was in Burton Taylor's.
What did you do?
I was just selling stuff. When I was 16, I worked at a chemist, you know, you're just doing like Saturday job, holiday job. And I worked as a car park attendant for Worthing Council. And I did that for a while, you know, quite
a
long.
Did you get people tickets?
I did actually. Yeah. I got punched twice.
No.
Yeah.
Oh, that's horrible.
But it was a drunk fisherman. I'd booked his car because he didn't have a ticket or something. And so he punched me.
He didn't slap you with a wet fish.
But even then I stuck around.
Yeah.
So I've always sort of hung around a bit.
I think I haven't had that many jobs because...
We're the wrong people to ask, basically.
Yeah,
Gina.
Because basically I'm a freelancer. But I can tell you, so therefore the shortest job that I ever worked with was the very first job I had was working in a supermarket in which I had to do two shifts. One of them was Thursday night and then the other one was Saturday during the day. So Thursday was 5 till 7 and then Saturday was 8 till 5 and then you got your wage, then you could go out on a Saturday night. And the thing that I had to do for most of the time I was there was to, and the supermarket chain will remain nameless because of this, was to make the mincemeat. And the way that you made the mincemeat was you were in the freezer thing. You got these slabs, like a slab that was this yay big. I've got my arms, so I don't know how big that is. Like a
meter and a bit.
Meter and a bit, okay. Of frozen meat and then a slab of frozen cow fat. Yeah, and then what you had to do was you put them in, there would be like a big basin which had a hole in one corner, which had a grinder, and you had a pestle, the thing that you... What you had to do was, firstly, the stuff came out frozen.
Grinder with an E, by the way, yes.
Yeah, grinder with an E. The stuff would come out. You'd have to defrost it by running hot water over it, and then you had to smash it up, and then you had to smash the meat and the cow fat through the grinder and then take it all out and then do it again and put it through the grinder so that the cow fat, which was just fat, became like mixed up with the meat so that you couldn't tell it. And the way that it worked was premium mince was one slab of meat to one slab of cow fat, and knockdown mince, the bargain, was one slab of meat to two slabs of cow fat.
Nice. And how long did you stick that job for?
6 weeks. And then I got a job in Gene Genie. Because after the sort of fourth or fifth week of making mincemeat out of cow fat, I was walking back home on the Thursday night and I saw a jeans shop in which I saw people whose hands were clean. And I thought, and they had a thing and they said assistants wanted. And I went in and said, well, yes.
They didn't say, you stink of fat, get out.
Actually, said, well, if you've been in Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you'd always look like you've been in a fight. And then I got the job and then I literally didn't go back the next day.
That was serendipity.
It was serendipity and it was mellifluous.
It was. Thank you very much for all the questions. There's some we didn't get to. We'll knock them on over for next week or send us a brand new question or indeed a schmestion, just anything you'd like to just pop on for take 3. Correspondence@kirbydemayo.com. We'll be back with take 1 and take 2 on Friday.